In the Book of Mormon, in Alma 29, verse 8, there's an interesting statement. In fact, this is one of the stimulations that encouraged my sons and I and my family and many others to research and look into the various discoveries that are being made worldwide, most of them since 1892. This verse says, "For behold, the Lord doth grant unto all nations of their own nation and tongue to teach his word, yea, in wisdom, all that he seeth fit that they should have." The Book of Mormon in 1829 stated that all nations had a degree of the gospel sufficient for their needs. This would mean then if you studied ancient cities and empires and countries and modern and ancient as well, there should be in each of those areas a certain degree of the gospel. Now what gospel? The Christian gospel of 1829? No. The gospel as Joseph Smith restored it in 1829 to 1844 before they shot him to death. In those 15 years, he restored a whole scheme, doctrinal and organizational practices totally foreign to the Christian world of his day. And yet he said that the early Christian church had had the organization and the doctrines, as well as many other nations, including the Jewish nation, as a very early pattern. But there was no evidence of such in 1829 or 1830, or even until the discoveries were made and translated. Much of the evidence confirming the prophet Joseph Smith and the restored gospel has been found since 1945 and only made available since 1972. The discovery, however, of the Cave of 1000 Buddhas goes back to an earlier period, and yet it's taken nearly 3/4 of a century to catalog and start getting some of the material available in even English translation. There are today 12 historical living religions. Some of you are familiar with many of them, of course. The reason they're called living religions is because they are still active, having had a long historical history. There are nearly 2,000 different totemisms and over 725 Christian denominations, 52 different Buddhist sects. But nevertheless, there's 12 living religions of which Christianity is merely one. Buddhism is another one. The oldest world living religion today is Hinduism. It goes back before 2000 BC. We're preparing a tape sometime in the future showing the parallelism of early Hinduism to the restored gospel. Judaism, of course, goes back to the time of Moses, but Joseph Smith said its history antiquated Moses by almost another 2,500 years, going back to the time of Adam. There was no evidence in his day of any such thing, but there is now. Shintoism goes back to 600 BC, or a little before. A peculiar Japanese religion. There's also Zoroastrianism, again 600 BC. This particular area is in Iran and Iraq in the Persian area. Taoism, also about 600 BC, founded in the Far East. And then Jainism, also 600 BC. Something's going on about 600 BC. Quite plainly, Buddhism about 560 to 600 BC in India, and Confucianism 550 to 600 BC in China again, and Christianity about the time of Christ. But then, of course, the Old Testament is referred to many times in the New Testament, and it goes back to an earlier history. Mohammedanism, a living religion today, is about 600 AD. And Sikhism is about 1400 to 1500 AD. Now those are the 12 main living religions which occupy most of the world's population today. Now nearly one-third of the world's population today is Buddhism or related type teachings and sects. There was a great discovery that was made some time ago about which very few people know. Some of you may take the Smithsonian Magazine. Do any of you take the Smithsonian Magazine? Well, in the May issue for last year, there was actually a story of the discovering ancient treasures in the caves of the 1000 Buddhas with photographs for the first time that I know anywhere available of the 10-foot stacks of scrolls that were found in that great discovery. And a description also of Ariel Steen, the discoverer. The reason the article came out is because a bibliography and a biography of the discoverer, Ariel Steen, had just been published by Jeanette Mirsky at the University of Chicago Press. That book is now available, and other materials have since become available in the last 2 years, some of which I have here on the table. And some of the material we're referring to tonight I just received in the last 60 to 90 days. If you were to look for the place where the Cave of 1000 Buddhas is located, I doubt whether in your libraries you could find a map showing the location. But you might. You might go home this evening and see if you can find a little place called Tunhang. T-U-N-H-U-A-N-G. See if you can find it on a map. Chinese Turkestan. But I can give you a little description. Perhaps in your mind you'll have a vivid idea of its locality. There's a huge desert called the Taklamakan Desert, stretching for 1,400 miles. You've heard of the Kashmir Mountains and the Kashmir Pass. You've also heard of Tibet. The western sector of this great Taklamakan Desert is the corner of Tibet. And Pakistan and Turkestan border on the western part of the Lop Nor, the great Taklamakan Desert. To the north of this great desert is what they call Tian Shan Mountains, the Celestial Mountains. They border on Russia and Mongolia. And then to the east is the great Paishan Mountains of China. So this border area, or the Taklamakan Desert, really is that sector where China, Mongolia, Russia, Tibet, Afghanistan, and Pakistan and India come together. A huge, immense desert. Across this great desert, there were two trails, one along the base of the Celestial Mountains, the Tian Shan, and another one to the south along the southern border of the Taklamakan, or the great Kuen Rang Range of Mountains, the great mountains part of the Himalayas that you're very familiar with, which of course is part of Tibet. And how many of you haven't been at one time or another interested in the writings of one of the authors about Tibet, the lost city? And some of you have undoubtedly been interested in mysticism and Tibetism and Lamism and Buddhism. And there's always that intrigue that appeals to every one of us. But Buddhism 1978 is not Buddhism of 400 BC. As a result of the discoveries found in the Caves of 1000 Buddhas, there is an entire reassessment as to the nature, character, and the philosophical implications of Buddhism. If the Book of Mormon is correct, then great countries of vast population should somehow or another have had sufficient for their needs of the ancient gospel, as enunciated by Joseph Smith. This is such a tremendous and interesting challenge. One of the great proofs that Joseph is a prophet is to find in all the great discoveries, from the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Nag Hammadi and 27 others in Palestine and Egypt, and then the others in Turfan, China, Chinese Turkestan, Iran, Iraq, and in Central America, all today confirming the presence of the ancient gospel in its unique details, organizational practices, pre-existent teachings. No Christian church taught the pre-existence in 1829. But all of these ancient religions have a detailed pre-existent doctrine, a mother and heaven, a father, a family, a divine son, the spirit, and a rebeller, Satan, or the equivalent of an evil one. Well, let's go back then a little bit and give you some history and bring you across the Taklamakan Desert. You're already familiar with it, whether you remember it or not. The Cave of 1000 Buddhas is an oasis where the great crossroads from Tibet, India, China, and Mongolia, and those two trails I mentioned to you converge. It's an area that today many immigrants and pilgrims go nearly every May. It's a vast vehicle and horse-drawn and everything going into this area to worship and there to have conferences nearly every spring of the year. It's been going on for vast centuries of time. It's an area that, while we don't hear about it, drew attention to someone you all know. And in fact, in the year 1250, when Marco Polo passed along the Silk Trade Route, because that's what those trails were, the great caravan, the trade areas that went back into the centuries before the time of Christ, that permitted the exchange of goods and silks and spices and everything across the vast continents from China to Europe. This was what Columbus was trying to find. It was a sea route to this particular area. But that particular man, Marco Polo, when he went into the city of Sichao, or today known as Tunhang, the area, the city of the Cave of 1000 Buddhas, the vault in which the documents were found this century had already been sealed for centuries and were to remain to be sealed until found here this century. A little background perhaps then, let's go to an account by Ariel Steam himself. He arrived in the city of the Cave of 1000 Buddhas, it was in March about 1906. On the almost perpendicular conglomerate cliffs, rising great tiers, I caught sight of the first grottos, the caves. A multitude of dark cavities, mostly small, were seen here, honeycombing the somber rock, faces in irregular tiers from the foot of the cliffs, where the stream almost washed them, to the top of the precipice. In bewildering multitude and closeness, the lines of the grottos presented their faces, some high and some low, perched one above the other without any order or arrangement in stories. 1,000 grottos containing the great and small images of Buddha. Rough stairs cut into the cliff and still rougher wooden galleries served as approaches to the higher caves. Many of these seemed on the point of crumbling away and have since done so. And high up in the topmost rows were manifestly shrines which had become quite inaccessible. I noticed that the fresco paintings covering the walls of all the grottos in which he is able to get access were beautiful and well preserved. The cave of the 1,000 Buddhas were indeed tenanted by images of the enlightened one himself. In the area where the great discovery of scrolls was found, the Buddha that was sitting in that particular cave was 3 stories high. Some of the grottos were 9 stories high, at the top of which were immense Buddhas sitting on the upper sort of the Toryon-ni type pagoda buildings in which the Buddhas were housed. It was March the 16th, 70 some odd years ago. Thus Ariel Steen described his first view of Shaofuntan, Cave of the 1,000 Buddhas. The cave temple near the oasis of Tuanhang. 3 weeks ago, I talked to an Indian specialist in my own field. He had just come from Tuanhang, and we sat down and had an interesting discussion and discourse about what was going on there. They've now got an airfield in there because it's still an area of pilgrimage. It's very well known and very famous in that region, and yet to many Westerners and white people, it's absolutely unknown. Its ancient place name of Sashao, meaning City of the Sands, speaks of forbidding, desolate surroundings, just as the lavishly decorated grottos indicate that for centuries in that location there had been a strategic place of trade and religion. What about Ariel Steen himself? Where did he come from? Why and how had he made his way to that great city? And what was Tuanhang? What rumor had lured him from India to distant Kansu? Well, the questions arise because time has erased the memory of that discovery from most of our literature and books. And that's the reason why it's now being resuscitated, because now the material being cataloged is being brought out in translation. I have some of the translation material here. The new discoveries add significantly to the knowledge of China's past and revitalizes and revolutionizes our knowledge of Buddhism. He was a Hungarian-born individual, born in 1862, a scholar and an archaeological explorer. He was one of the hardiest handful of pioneers who, at the beginning of the century, 78 years ago, probed Central Asia to trace the ancient caravan routes known collectively as the Silk Road from about 100 BC. These great caravans traversed transcontinental areas and linked China and the West. It was on his second expedition in 1906 that lasted for 2 years that Ariel Steen brought the attention of Europe to the secret treasure of Tuanhang. His journey there was arduous but of a kind singular appealing to him. I have his personal accounts and some of his diary notes. They're quite exciting. At Kashgar on the great western area of the Taklamakan Desert, he had been helped by a British resident there who had the good fortune to get him a secretary by the name of Shang Suye, who was well versed in Chinese and several other languages, who also had wit and courage. Provided a great companion, he was devoted and helped lighten the hardship and loneliness of field work in the Taklamakan Desert. Ariel Steen was also a surveyor. He was to survey many of the mountain passes and the routes, found many ruins and made many significant discoveries during the many years that he worked in the great mountain areas there. In this great basin, from east to west, it is a sea of sand and marshes. Fierce winds move it wave-like. Sand dunes migrate back and forth across, hiding ancient trails. The islands within it are hideous salt crusts and lay capriciously carved by the winds. The Taklamakan suffers the worst extremes of climate anywhere on earth. Lofty, snow-covered mountains ring the Taklamakan on 3 sides, the Pamirs on the west and the Tin Shan Celestial Mountains to the north, and the Kunlun to the south. They hold immense reservoirs of snow and ice, which, melting, feed rivers, furnishing life-giving waters for oases spaced along the desert's perimeter. Many walled areas and guard points were traced by aerial steam along the Silk Path. The rivers, without exception, flow helplessly into the desert and perish there. It's a completely enclosed basin. The oases are stations along the caravan routes and define the two roads connecting east and west. Now, I already mentioned the two different roads, but here, where they converge with other roads going northeast and south and west at Twinhang, Saishou, the City of Sands, the roads meet, and here they enter China. And there, too, are the other roads from the great Tibetan-Mongolian areas. The Twinhang cave temples, vibrant with art, had been mentioned to Steen by a member of a Hungarian geological expedition to Chinese Turkestan years earlier. He had planned to visit them himself in doing surveys in the eastern basin, but his main task continued to be tracking down and excavating sand-buried sites well within the desert itself at Lop Nor. Had cities called Rawak, Dandan, and Nija had yielded hundreds of documents on wood, it was Ariel Steen himself who found the earliest specimen of paper dated 105 A.D. En route to this great oasis, he was actually trying to beat a German in a French expedition who got held up at Kashgar. He didn't realize their delays, so he was a little harassed for time. And what they would do sometimes was pack ice wrapped in cloth for their water, because along the salt marshes there was just no source of water at all, so they'd take ice. And that was their sole source of water on that desert. It was cold enough to keep it pretty frozen. Then when he entered into the central part of the desert, he was told by an individual that a Taoist monk had become the self-appointed guardian of the cave temples. And he had recently found a mass of papers inside of a side chapel bricked up ages ago. The news was electrifying to Steen. So he made a very special effort and a much of an arduous overland effort to get into Twinhang in order to have first access, and he arrived in mid-May. He established camp at the caves. Caution balanced his eagerness. He watched the long procession of carts bringing people there on their annual pilgrimage. And only when the tide of worshipers had receded did he then pitch his own tents at the grass-covered orchard area below some of the great grottos. His secretary, Shang, made himself cozy in a cool room at the foot of a three-story high seated Buddha, something like a Kamakura, Japan. I've spent 3 years in the Orient, and I'm quite familiar with pagodas and Buddhist organizations, and myself was initiated into some of their society. This first impression that Steen received when he was there, particularly of the Taoist monk, was really a very poor one. The individual who was the caretaker, self-appointed, was poor, almost illiterate. He had begged his way halfway across China 8 years and settled at the cave temples. 2 years in 1904, while trying to repair and restore one of the great grottos and the great Buddha three stories high, he had found a chink in some of the wall. And when he tried to repair that, it opened into a grotto. And in behind the grotto were these vast piles of scrolls. This was what Chang found out, and what Steen was interested in, and it took a long time, a very patient conversation and persuasion to get Wang to even tell them a little bit more of the detail. Finally, Wang, the Taoist monk, told Chang that the manuscript find had been reported to the Viceroy of Kansu, and therefore he was reticent to make them available to an Englishman or anyone else. He had even sent a few rolls of the Chinese texts as specimens, but however, the officials, when they found out it would take 7 carts to bring all the scrolls in, decided that it was a little bit prohibitive in terms of cost in those days, and so nothing had happened. The collection was left undisturbed in the Taoist monk's care. Because of this lack of interest in high officialdom, it permitted Steen then to make a vast and tremendous discovery. As a matter of fact, archaeologically, China didn't get going until the late 20s. And as you know now, it's got a very high, sophisticated archaeological group, and you've seen some of the recent discoveries here announced in the National Geographic and elsewhere. But it took them about 20 years after this great discovery to get going. There was a period of time then while they were negotiating to get access to the documents. One of the things that Steen had been motivated by was an ancient traveler, a Chinese, by the name of Huson Tang. He was actually a saintly, influential 7th century pilgrim. This individual had actually been probably responsible for the movement and shifting of Buddhism through many sectors of this ancient area. He himself had prepared documents and likewise had left a great legacy. He had become sort of the patron saint of Steen. So then, one very long night, the Taoist monk brought one document for Chang to look at. Chang groped his way to Steen's tent, clutching a bundle that Wang had secretly brought to him. When at daybreak, after Chang had looked at it all the night, he returned with wonder and triumph shown on his face. At the end of the scroll, it had apparently been itself prepared and translated by Hu Sangtang himself, the patron saint of Ariel Steen. Was it not clear then, said Chang to the Taoist monk? This was a sign, therefore, why Steen's patron saint was giving this blessing. And therefore, how could he forbid Steen to see the hidden treasure? This quasi-divine hint overcame Wang's apprehension. That afternoon in the siesta hours, when prying eyes were shut, he opened the recess to Steen and Chang. They peered into the blackness. Illuminated by Wang's little lamp, Steen saw a solid mass of manuscript bundles rising to the height of nearly 10 feet and filling, as subsequent measurements showed, close on 500 cubic feet. The area left clear within the room was just sufficient for two people to stand in the midst of the documents. They were later to remove 25,000 scrolls. Those scrolls, when they opened end on end, reached for 20 miles. The scrolls averaged about 30 to 45 feet long and a foot wide. Some were 70 feet long. Obviously, no examination of the manuscripts was possible in that black hole. Well, the days went by, of course. Wang would bring a few, and he seemed to have fortuitously chosen the best in all cases without knowing. The rolls, of course, then were made available, and scrutiny was very slow. But suddenly, on the reverse side of a particular Chinese scroll, Steen saw the cursive Indian Brahmi, or script that he was familiar with. It offered absolute proof that some of the manuscripts belonged to the early centuries of the Christian era, when Indian writing and some knowledge of Sanskrit still prevailed in Central Asian Buddhism. It was proof, too, of the close vital tie between Buddhist monasteries in India and the Tarim Basin. Steen's archaeological conscience was now satisfied. The dryness of the recess, cut into the living rock and sealed by the wall of drift sand that had been itself blocked up and bricked and plastered, it was an ideal repository for nearly 1,000 years for these great documents. Day after day, what Steen called this curious digging, with Wang bringing a bundle of documents for them to look through, went on and on. Each night, the day's harvest was carried to Steen's tent. Systematic selection was impossible. Steen aimed to amass what he could and trust to luck. Eventually, Steen prepared a caravan, and the Taoist monk permitted him to take most of the contents of that grotto. 5 carts were needed to carry 24 cases of manuscripts, and then 5 others that were filled with silk paintings. Now, the silk paintings and the documents are most important because it shows the condition of Buddhism in the 4th and 5th and 6th century AD. It's not like Buddhism 1978. Something had happened. People had tampered with the doctrines, and they'd grossly been assimilated and distorted. Steen presented Wang with 4 horseshoes of silver. He'd given him 3 rupees, just a pittance to start with. Wang had been out begging, trying to get money to refurbish and to redo these great grottos. And as a consequence, when he got enough money, he'd come back and then he would repair and clean and move sand out and everything. And so with the silver that was given to him by Steen, he was able to stop some of his begging activities. And while it seemed to be a small amount of money in that area, it was a very small fortune. And so the silver that was given to Wang by Steen, equal to about 500 rupees, to Wang, it was a handsome contribution to his restoration fund. That's what he was about, trying to do. Today, when Chinese archaeology is spectacularly successful, it's easy to forget that until the 1920s, Chinese scholars had not used the spade to investigate any of their own past. Today, they call Steen a bandit for having kidnapped their ancestral records. Actually, in the last few years, 10,000 more scrolls have appeared in Peking and other places in the Orient. That one little grotto was not the only one containing scrolls. And as a consequence, if they had clandestinely been removed by anybody else, they may have been lost to history. So the 25,000 items contained within the hidden recesses and returned to London, Paris, Leningrad, and Peking A great deal of their survival was dependent upon Sting being at the right place at the right time. How many times that happens historically? The manuscripts span a period of time from the first centuries of the Christian era and contain Old Testament materials and New Testament materials as well. Many of the Buddhist materials date around 400 and go to about 955. They had lain hidden and forgotten for almost 1,000 years. It was claimed that such an unbroken sequence is hardly be paralleled in any other literature of the past. Of course, since then, the Dead Sea Scrolls and Nag Hammadi and many other documents have been found. Now, that's a brief description of the discovery. I'll give you a little more details from some of his diary and his notes. And then we'll get into some of the contents of some of the documents and show you why they might be significant to LDS. But even now, tens of thousands of documents are being brought piece by piece into dealers' hands by circuitous routes. They reach Western collections. And when they do, they often vanish and they don't become available because they're clandestinely acquired. Fortunately, Steen's great and beautiful discovery was in one large mass. The young monk was eager to show his appreciation of the visitor's interest in the holy things. The first document that he brought him, of course, and many others, turned out to have iconographs, paintings, and silk paintings. Now, these have become quite important. So special studies are being made of Buddhism in Afghanistan and Central Asia. And what they deal with are all the pictures and photographs, and that's what you see here, of all the different traditions of Gautama Buddha, the history and background, the rituals, and all the various things associated with ancient Buddhism. And that by taking them and preparing them and making them available to the world, then we can see just what distortion has taken place in 1,500 years in the ancient Buddhism. It's proliferated, of course, now to more than 52 sects, two of which are of prime importance, one of which I was associated with in the Orient myself. One of the longest of all the documents was nearly 70 feet. Some of the silk paintings and some of the documents, many of the scrolls, were in very fine preserved paper. The calendars to which these particular documents seem to apply indicate that the deposit was made by a group of individuals prior to an invasion occurring in the region. And it seems as if a great deal of the records are copies made from some going back to 1 to 400 BC. And so this provides us a great deal of insight into Buddhism in its very early stages. One of the reasons that the little Taoist monk gave Steen these records, because he was trying to acquire special merit. And by letting Steen take these back, then he was getting some kind of a special consideration that he believed in. But he was very nervous and postponed delivery for a long time. This is a little bit more detail of the event that one evening. Steen was a very patient man. After a certain amount of postponement and nervousness, Wang brought this single document hidden under his robe to the tent of Shang. Then Chang groped his way to the tent of Steen in the silent evening hours and in silent elation showed him the Chinese documents. And then he studied them all night. He turned up by daybreak and with a face expressing both triumph and amazement reported that these fine rolls of paper contained the Chinese version of certain sutras, which is the Buddhist word for scriptures. From the Buddhist canon, which the end of the scrolls or the colophons declared to have been brought from India and translated by that 7th century pilgrim we talked about earlier, Husan Sang. The heavens had spoken, and so it was. Wang, then the Taoist monk, was able to be persuaded then to pick out and bring in specimens, and so we've given you the essential details. It appears as if the documents had been walled up somewhere around 998 A.D. when the Emperor Xin Song was trying to extend his reign beyond China. There was a threat of a destructive invasion. It did occur, and a consequence, those who apparently walled up the documents were destroyed or killed, and their knowledge and where they'd been hid up was lost to history until they were found in 1904 by the Taoist monk. Now let's go to the content of some of the documents and tell you a little bit about Buddhism as such. Now West Central Asia, today also known as Sogdiania and Bactria, and present-day Afghanistan, and to the east of the Pamirs at the foot of the Great Celestial Mountains, here in East Central Asia, the Tarim Basin, and in the Chinese province of Xinjiang, all of these were centers of Buddhism during the first 1,000 years of our time. Between Iran and China, to the north of India and Tibet, stretch vast regions torn between the desert and the mountains. For centuries, they were the site of the trade routes of which Marco Polo himself. And you know, for centuries, they thought that Marco Polo's book, even in Europe, was just myth, imagination. Even in Columbus's time, it was hard to believe his stories of this great migration. Marco Polo had misestimated the distance that he had traveled by almost a factor of one-third. In other words, he said it was about 1,200 miles, and it was actually about 3,600. So he really didn't have a rodometer or something that he could measure with. He was just guessing. The Silk Road, as it came to be called, was in fact a network of caravan trails which converged at certain mountain passes, the Pamir, the Karakoram, these mystic areas you've heard about in literature and everything. And here, of course, at certain points, were the political powers. And here's where power passed east and west, as you had the great migrations of people. You've also heard of the Genghis Khan and all the others. They had to pass through the desert in order to make their conquests here in Europe. Yet it is possible that Buddhism reached certain large oases in the east central area, such as at Kuwait, and even before the Christian era, by way of missionaries in the wake of the caravans. The problems about the introduction of Buddhism in East Central Asia are connected with the arrival of the same religion in China. And when this took place, a question which has still not been answered is still being investigated by the students of Buddhism. Rather than being Indians, the first missionaries, translators in China were mainly Sogdians. And much of the material that I have here is Sogdian. And that's what I'll be reading to you from here. The Acta Iranica, the Buddhist Sogdian text of the British Library from Steen's discoveries. Here, of course, is the source of the iconography or the paintings and everything so that they can see exactly what had been happening over those years. Now, if you leave Gandhara by the Khyber Pass, and you've all heard of the Khyber Pass, I'm trying to mention a few things you're familiar with, you'll go over to the plain of the Kabul River. Here you'll find the great monastic complex of Hadda, because Buddhism originated out of northern India. This is near present-day Jalalabad. Here was erected great stupas containing the relics of Buddha himself. The iconography which appeared in Hadda is the expression of a Buddhism in which there is still no clear differentiation between Buddha and the Bodhisattva. Besides the favorite material of the artists of Hadda, which was clay, they molded and painted. And here we have an encounter which you frequently find in Central Asia. However this may be, the colossal Buddhas and the paintings already reflect the transformation which were gradually to lead to the religion of Mahayana. The two other great Buddhist centers at Fonduskistan and Tepeyasarda in its later phases are a very different matter and display another wave of influences coming from India in the 7th and 8th centuries. So what they're trying to do now is reconstruct Buddhism as it was back between 400 BC and 200 to 400 AD. It is generally agreed that the earliest images of Buddha appeared in the schools of Gandhara and Mathura during the first centuries AD. This would be in Afghanistan and India. And we find the type elaborated there. There's standing Buddhas. There's also what they call the Kshitagarbha. This seemed to have been unknown in India and only appeared at late stages in the text translated into Chinese. So the equivalent of an apostasy, great changes occurred over these centuries. But since these documents were buried, greater changes have occurred until you couldn't recognize ancient Buddhism on the basis of what you have today. There's a mention here of this particular part of the Buddhist background. It's called the Sutra of the Ten Wheels. Here, the individual is called the conductor of souls. Now, where have we heard about that? Rodin, Raphael, and in the Book of Mormon, the angel that takes you back is in charge of the soul, spirits of men, whom he helps to steer away from the paths of evil. And he appears to be disguised as a monk back in those early centuries, 400 to 600 AD. A more complete translation was made by that pilgrim we told you about, the translator, and he attests his popularity and the recognition of this aid, this individual who helped conduct the souls of men. There's also an individual who's also clad in a patched robe who carries the bread and the bowl of water and the karhara. There's also the checkered garment and the so-called medicine bowl. These were later transformed into other variations. There's a wall painting from another place of about the 10th century. Here we see in the change made in the type of robe and the thing that they're carrying. And there's also an instrument in his hands by which he strikes the gate and the veil leading to hell or heaven. And of course, they've lost a lot of that in the last 900 years. There's also an inscription in the 5th century together with the small little baby Buddhas, the children or the young Buddhas, whose aspects are no more clearly characterized than his own. There seems to have been the development of a gradual method, and then there appears to be personages. These are the manifestation of wisdom and supreme perfection of the doctrine of Buddha. There's also an individual representing the word and the sound. These individuals appear in rich princely costumes. Later on, many of them were to be distorted. And some of you have seen recent paintings of Buddhists. They have fangs and many arms and things like that, and they're all distorted. But there's reasons for that. Symbolism grew gradually. For example, there was a particular person, Manjushri, and there's a representation of the golden lion and the white elephant, which figures greatly in Buddhism. And there's 6 tusks. And the particular elephant is led by a dark-skinned Indian-looking man. Both mounts, the lion and the elephant, symbolize the irresistible force of knowledge. What Buddhism has lost today has been the symbolism of what was represented back in those early days. There's also attendance of the super-terrestrial Buddha in a vast assembly of transcendental beings. There's also a triad, group of 3 mentioned. There's the blue lotus as well. We'll tell you what the lotus means a little bit as we go along. Now, Vajrapani is one of the most familiar figures of the Buddhism of both vehicles. They have a little vehicle and call a great vehicle, and all that really means is that to the groups of people who couldn't understand a lot of things, they weren't permitted to get out of orthodoxy. But in the greater vehicle, there was greater latitude and tolerance. And this greater vehicle, it spread so widely and involved so many things and assimilated so many things, it distorted the whole works. There was also an individual that I just mentioned. He implied a notion of force. This goes back into great antiquity. And we'll mention some other aspects and the significance of that. There's also the reference to indestructible truth. And in Turfan region, there's the esoteric meaning held in the hands of the figures. And again, we find the emblems of the mandalas. We'll mention that too. Now, minor divinities and divinities found in modern Buddhism didn't exist then. They've all been assimilated in the last 1,500 years and added to the whole thing there. They have what they call the local palace. These are the guardian kings of the 4 cardinal points, and they appear in the art of Gandhara in the course of one of the episodes in the life of Buddha. The military character assumed subsequently by these figures seemed to have arisen in Central Asia, and perhaps more precisely in the Khotan region of the Lopnor Desert. The 2 booted statues discovered by Ariel Steen near the gates of the stupa, one of these is of that kind. In cave number 285, 4 of these were found, and they already appear with their distinctive attributes. The faces have begun to assume a furious expression, which was to be so characteristic later on, and the costume becomes hybrid. The long floating robes that originally were worn by these individuals finally become breastplates and armor. And so from what seemed to have once been a robe, garment of priesthood, it had finally become totally distorted in the very opposite direction. They now appear in military dress. And they even have arrows and a spear and a sword and a club. This too has been portrayed in certain of the portable wooden altars. Wooden altar, what might that represent in ancient Buddhism? And then they're standing on a lotus, dressed in the long coats of mail, holding their attribute, the archaic costume, making them look more like warriors than what they originally were. So the distortion continues. There was also a wearing of a crown with 3 elements, and that's been distorted now into spears. Crown is sometimes ornamented by a bird. They have what they call the axis. The ancient cults assimilated by Buddhism can be detected particularly clearly in a whole group of secondary figures and semi-divine beings who sometimes assume a special importance and who usually survived in popular legends recounted by Chinese pilgrims. Later, most of them were assimilated by the Mahayana Buddhism and then by Tantrism, which developed their esoteric characteristics to excess and led to the extremes now found in Lamaism. Lamaism today is an extreme change, altered Buddhism. The axis became hybrid beings, demigods of nature and of vegetation, demons of fertility who could be beneficial or malevolent by turn. They unquestionably remained deities venerated by the masses in a cult in those regions where the monks had preached the law and found their numerous monasteries. Thus the submission of the Yaksas to the master's doctrine gave the masses of the population whom they protected access to Buddhism. A distortion was made to conform to people who were illiterate and mediocre. Their cult were so renowned that it had been possible to chart their respective localities and their growth clear across the borders of China from the 3rd century on. In Central Asia, they were successors of the barbarous types of Gandhara and were distinguished by their fawn-like ears and protruding fangs. They often aroused the imagination of artists who provided only too delightfully the terrifying aspects and thereby satisfied popular beliefs. And an old store of more or less zoomorphic primitive religions crept in, and Buddhism had finally become totally indistinguishable from its origins. But it seems rather remarkable that the monstrous embellishment of these demonic types and the fanciful developments of this semi-animal and hideous pantheon should have taken place in the vicinity of the frontiers of Iran, in contact with the Avestan religions, which were also peopled by devas and gardevas. The dryads, or another group of figures in the pantheon of participants in ancient Buddhism and modern Buddhism. There's also the Gandharvas. The Gandharvas are a music playing. They're even a harp player. You can see long parallels there going way back. There's transcendent scenes of the Buddhist legends, and they have served in the Hinayana sect to express the superhuman destiny of the enlightened one. There's indeterminate sects of such as supernatural creatures. There's cosmic deities and many others as well. More or less successful imitations can be found throughout the entire basin. So I think you're getting the picture there in terms of what has been going on in the mountainous area and what they have been finding. Now, quickly, to give you just a few basic ideas that we're confronted with in our own time, this is a reconstruction of the early life of Buddha. Can you see any parallels? This goes back to what they call the Second Great Council, about 388 B.C., There was a Sakya, a king, strong of purpose and reverence by the men of a descendant. He was called Gautama, and his wife, Maya Deva, was beautiful. And as the queen of heaven, she lived on earth, untainted by desire, and she was immaculate. And the king, her husband, honored her in her loneliness, and the spirit of truth, glorious and strong in his wisdom, like a white elephant, descended upon her. When she knew that the hour of motherhood was near, she asked the king to send her home to parents. And he was anxious then to do as his wife desired. When the pain of travail came upon her, four pure-minded angels of the great Brahma held out a golden net to receive the babe. And then Brahma angels took the child and placed him before the mother and said, "Rejoice, O queen, a mighty son has been born unto thee." At her couch stood an aged woman imploring the heavens to bless the child. All the world was flooded with light. The blinding received their sight by longing to see the coming glory of the Lord. The deaf and the dumb spoke with one another, and the good omens indicating the birth of the Buddha to be. And the crooked became straight. The lame walked, and all prisoners were freed from their chains, and the fires of all hells were extinguished. No clouds gathered in the sky, and nor the polluted streams, they became clear. Celestial music rang out through the air, and the angels rejoiced with gladness. For our creation engulfed in the ocean of pain was now to obtain release. The cities of heavens were hushed, and all the malevolent beings received a loving heart, and peace reigned on the earth. And Mara, the evil one, alone was grieved and rejoiced not. The queen mother beheld her child. And there was living by a hermit. He was a Brahmin. The seer, beholding the prince, wept and sighed deeply. "Why has the sight of my son caused thee grief and pain?" The king, like the moon who is full, should feel great joy. He says, "I do not worship Brahma, but I worship the child. And the gods in the temple will descend from their places of honor, banish all anxiety and doubt. And the spiritual omens manifested indicate the child now born will bring salvation and deliverance to the whole world." And you can go on and reconstruct. You can see the parallels there. Somehow or another, 600 B.C., a very distinctly parallel anticipation of the birth of the Savior was being enunciated. It goes on and describes many very other parallels. I have here 8 major parallels between Buddhism and Mormonism. There's types of redemption in a book just received. And here's one that's called Faith and Knowledge in Early Buddhism. This particular book here points out that very ancient sutras now being identified talk about the objective aspect of the divine, the power and powers, higher powers of God. In a special conference that was held in Lancaster in 1975 that redefined religion, it is our feeling that religion can be most characteristically described as the inner experience of an individual when he sees a beyond. In one of the great sutras of ancient Buddhism, the individual says, destroyed is birth, brought to a close is the Brahma-fearing, done is what to be done, there is no more of being such or such, and the expectation is to go on into a great and vast beyond, to become perfect, and being able to throw off all the shackles and fetters, and to have utmost and complete release. This is in variance at the feeling of nihilism that comes in some of the Buddhist teachings. And then here's a whole book on Satan and Mara. If I were to read the content, you'd find an absolute parallel between Satan and Mara, right even down to the realm and power and his final defeat from his beginning, where he was a rebeller, and how he confuses, perplexes, kills and destroys, his powers and everything, almost directly parallel to Satan. The life of Buddha that has just been now being reconstructed, you can get certain materials on, made available. So we'll probably prepare a sequel tape on Buddhism, its doctrine and contents. This particular tape is for the benefit of discovery and the recovery of the ancient documents. What does it add up to? Simply another discovery in this century predicted by the prophet Joseph Smith on page 24 and 25 of the Book of Mormon, which would be found by non-Mormons, is now in translation form coming forth. There's one, this Buddhist Sogdian text I was telling you about has most of the contents of the 89th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. For example, which we, if time permitted, we would have read. So we'll provide that in another document. The Book of Mormon, of course, is filled with what we could call anticipatory, predictable areas. An archaeologist, a specialist, can go into it and say, now, it says certain things. We should be able to predict what might be found here or in some other place. The New Testament material found in the great text, the Old Testament material, show a vast influence of the early gospel upon ancient Buddhism. And only certain of the ancient Buddhist sects today still have some of those teachings. This might encourage you to look a little bit into some of the Buddhist texts and parallelism, but also perhaps to study the Book of Mormon in greater depth and detail, because that is really where it is all embedded. In the Doctrine and Covenants, the Pearl Gate Price, modern revelation, the substance of it all, and Joseph Smith predicted that there would be great, vast, beautiful books discovered that would confirm all the things of the gospel. They're now happening. There's a trickle of discovery going on. We talked about 10 discoveries in a tape number 93. And the Cave of 1,000 Buddhas was just one of those discoveries. As more material is made available, we'll try to assimilate it, make it available on a tape so that people have access to it. It strengthens my testimony to know that at one time I was initiated into a group of Buddhists. I tried to teach them about some of the great intelligences and spiritual doctrines of the church. They started listening to me, and I said, man, if you're listening to me, then you got problems. And so I read 100 church books to get a testimony of the gospel and found that this church of Jesus Christ is absolutely true. I give you that testimony in the name of Christ. Amen.